And I guess the house now has a...
We're here. Yeah. We're always here.
Yes. We're ready for the people.
The good senator's coming back from here, but Senator Devlin is the chair. It's going to be a few minutes late coming in, so we'll just start. We'll start this the hearing of the subcommittee on Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Senate Bill 5527. Okay. Please proceed. Introduce yourself and...
Glad to be here this morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm the Interim Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Thank you for having us back this morning. You will find on your notebooks, I believe, the responses to the questions that were posed last Monday. We'd be glad to cover those if the committee would like, or we can go ahead and move on to our presentation.
Okay, good. I'm turning it back over to the Vice Chair, Senator Gordley. So.
Let's please do go through the responses to the questions.
Okay, we'd be glad to. The first question that was posed to us a week ago was a concern about scholarships being unclaimed. Fortunately for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, all of our scholarships are claimed every year. If we see a scholarship area where there starts to be a diminished number of applications that seem to fit the requirements for it, we'll work with the donor, who is the sponsor, to help broaden the applicant pool that would be eligible. And you see it here in the handout, an example where the Sherwood Volunteer Firefighters Association started to have very few applicants for their scholarship, and we helped them expand the geographic area of the potential recipients for that. The broader concern that there are, you know, millions or billions of dollars in scholarships that go unclaimed, according to national research, shows that those are largely ones that are eligible for a very narrow population. For example, many employers provide educational assistance. Many employees do not avail themselves of that assistance either because of their work demands or family demands, or for a variety of reasons, they're not really utilizing that benefit in their employee benefit package. Also, many times, in particularly the private education sector, universities will offer students, dependents of employees, educational benefits. And in talking with many of those folks who work for those private institutions, they oftentimes express chagrin over the fact that many times their dependents choose to want to go to a different school other than the one where they can actually get those benefits. So we think that this is more myth than fact in terms of the broader scholarship pools that are available. To move on to the next question, I think the committee's interest was how many students are filing their applications for the federal student aid application process electronically versus paper. You'll see a small chart there that shows that there's a growing usage of web-based applications. Students can also still do the paper application, and then some students actually go to their school's financial aid office and get some assistance, and that institution will enter their information electronically. At the back of the handout, there's a breakout by each of Oregon's institutions where you can see the percent that's web-based versus paper applications.
Representative Wisnot, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Could you please tell me, is there any way, I've talked to some people that have used the system since our last meeting, is there, you know, if you know you're not going to qualify, but you're wanting the loan for scholarship, but you want the loan, you still have to fill out all the paperwork. So this was a complaint they had. Is there not some way we can change the system to say, I just need a, you know I don't qualify for scholarship, but I want a cost and not have to fill out all the paperwork?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, many of OSAC scholarships, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission scholarships, are a marriage of need along with merit. And we need to be able to look at their financial need situation, and our donors have different thresholds for what they define as need. And so they might not be eligible for the Pell Grant, but they instead might qualify under one of our donors' criteria for need in reviewing it. So we need for many of our applications still students to have that piece of the information. For some of ours, need is not considered at all. For example, the Bird Scholarship, it is entirely merit-based in that decision. And if a student had not sent the FAFSA information, that would not disqualify them from consideration for that scholarship. So it's a combination. We really encourage all students to do the FAFSA form because it's really hard for them to know that it's not going to come into consideration on all of the various things that they might be eligible for.
Madam Chair, comment to the committee, then we get into space too. I would probably ask that our presenters address why so many states do not require you to go through them to file this application. Some you file directly, but some go through the state. So we'll to see why we're doing it that way, because it's not. If you look at the front of the form, some of them can be submitted directly, but it looks like a third or whatever are go through the state. So we can wait and address that.
And may I ask you, Representative Wisnot, to repeat again what it is you would like to have revisited in Phase 2 with our trustee, Mr. Bender, back at his seat and with his pen ready to capture
the information.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Mr. Bender, I was expressing to the committee that we might in Phase 2 want to address why Oregon requires the form to be submitted through Oregon, where a lot of states it goes directly to the headquarters. But if you look on the front of the page on the form down at the bottom, why are we being listed as going through us or checking with us? Is that creating an unnecessary or is it unnecessary?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnan, if I could correct a misimpression, it is not filed through the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. All of the FAFSA forms are filed strictly through the U.S. Department of Education application process. It does not come through the state agency.
Madam Chair, but it says check with. So, I mean, they're doing something. You're doing something, providing some sort of service if it has that on the forms.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, that form is saying to check with your state in terms of what cutoff dates might apply in terms of your state's NEED grant program. And in Oregon, because we have to move those cutoff dates to various points, that's the reason why it's not posted in there officially, because the different cutoff dates will move depending upon the volume that we have of applications.
Deadlines.
But still, Madam Chair, what I'm saying is there's a lot of states that don't require that, so are we creating an FTE workload that we don't need to?
Yeah. We'll respond later, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
The committee asked the question of how many Oregon high school students participate in the Aspire program. The most recent data indicates that there are 435 public and private high schools in Oregon. The Aspire program serves 59 of those high schools, which is only 14% of the total number of high schools. But the student population that actually attends those high schools represents 28% of all high school age teens in Oregon. So our reach is a little bit better than what our just pure number of high schools is. And we would gladly expand the Aspire program if we were able to get more resources in which to do that. We are continually working with the various foundations in Oregon in order to be able to stretch those dollars further. The broader question then in terms of what is our overall outreach to students across Oregon, we do a variety of workshops all across the state, participate in college fairs in many local community colleges as well as the statewide college fairs, and then do presentations in a wide variety of settings in order to be able to have the general public and students understand what our resources and services are. We also do a lot of work with our web-based applications. We have a lot of traffic to those sites, and I would say from a consumer's perspective, our application for the scholarships and the website is one of the better ones that I used as a parent of a high school senior a year ago. To move on to question four, the committee wanted to know, when schools provide financial aid, how do they conduct random audits of the applications for financial aid, and what percentage of those applications is verified? The U.S. Department of Education puts a flag on the final form that is sent to the family that indicates that that document is going to be one subject to audit. That then triggers the notice to the school saying that they need to ask for supplemental documentation from that student or their family in order to verify the information that was included in it. That percentage is 30% of the applications.
Is that 30% random, or is there some triggering mechanism in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, it's a random percentage. The schools have to verify up to 30%. So if, for example, if they get a disproportionate number of those 30% of Oregon applicants who apply to go to their school, they only have to then actually audit up to 30% of the applicants that come to their school.
Yes, Representative.
I'm talking about the flag that appears originally. That comes from
the U.S. Department of Education, Representative Jensen.
Not our department.
No, it does not come from us at all.
Is that a random?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that is random. It's a bit like back when they were just starting the luggage screening process and the search process for us as potential passengers on airplanes. There would be some kind of flag that would be on our boarding pass that would tell them, look carefully at this customer. So, and it has nothing to do with any triggers to our knowledge that they see in what's submitted by families. The form there, the document also then tells you what kinds of things they're looking for. Oftentimes families will be asked to send most recent tax statements in order to show that the adjusted gross income figures and the number of exemptions or dependences as was reported on the FAFSA form. The committee also wanted to know what is the average debt for students at graduation for both public and private four-year institutions in Oregon. Unfortunately, we could not find any source of data for Oregon schools specifically, but we were able to find information about the level of indebtedness that students are leaving college with nationally. By sector and by whether their status was as an independent or a dependent student. So you will see on the table that looks like this the breakouts in terms of the borrowing levels, and it's a comparison between what those borrowing levels were in 1992-93 school year versus the 99-2000 school year. The general national data indicates that students who were in the neediest of families, their level of borrowing has not risen as fast as those more in the middle income categories, and that is because they were already borrowing very close to the maximums that was permissible for them in order to be able to go to school. Because of the increasing cost of higher education, that need to seek additional funding has crept more and more into middle-class families. And so we're seeing a higher level of indebtedness for those particular students and their parents.
Should be noted that you don't actually show family indebtedness there also.
Mr. Chairman, that is one of the challenges in that data is usually not kept in terms of parents borrowing. The recording of the debt is more from the student's perspective. So we know that many families have, in fact, taken advantage of the more favorable interest rates to refinance their homes and a variety of different mechanisms in order to help enable their students to be able to attend the college of their choice. So, and I'm sure you hear that from many of your constituents. To move on to question number seven, one of the committee members pointed out in our presentation that the majority of students are part-time students, and that it appeared that our projections for part-time students... Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Did you miss question six?
Oh, you're right, I did. It was on the other side of the page that I forwarded on. On question number six... We were asked to describe the financial aid controls that prevent a student from declaring themselves as an independent as a means of gaining a more favorable financial aid package for themselves. And this is an area where some students may consider doing this, and Uncle Sam, our partner, the U.S. Department of Education, is very aware of folks seeking ways in which to try to navigate this financial aid system to their best advantage. And because of that, they have put in place several barriers to families being able to do that sort of thing. First off, in order to be an independent, most students will need to be over 24 years of age. In order to be under 24 and to be deemed to be an independent, you then would have to meet several other qualifications. First, you would need to have been an orphan or a ward of the court through age 18. So for example, students who have come through the state's foster care system would meet this qualification if they were still in foster care on their 18th birthday. You could also be a veteran of the U.S. Armed Services. So we have many young students who are spending time in the armed services now, many of them abroad. Those students, those individuals, when they return, will be able to have an independent status, even if they're only 21, 22 years old. You would need to have legal dependents other than a spouse for whom you're already paying more than half of the cost of their support. So if you had an elderly parent that you were needing to support, and you could document that you were providing more than half of the cost of that person's cost of living, then you would be able to also be deemed an independent. You could be in graduate school. If you're in graduate school or professional school, and many students will graduate from their bachelor's program and go straight on to graduate school, those students will be deemed independent students in their graduate studies. Or be married on the day in which the student applies. So that would also then make them an independent student. In order to further discourage students from trying to become independent simply from moving away from home, the federal calculations also are always looking back at the previous year. And so this can be an important safeguard in order to prevent abuse, but it also can create some real challenges, for example, for people who have been gainfully employed who lose their job and then need financial assistance in order to be able to return to retrain themselves for another degree. Their previous year's employment income is going to prevent most of them from qualifying for financial aid under the either the Pell Grant or the Oregon Opportunity Grant. With that, I'd now like to move on to question 7. To readdress the question of the projected number of part-time students, the concern was that the number of part-time students looked very small in our projections for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and the interest was whether or not the 30% median family income cutoff for a single independent student was a part of what was causing that. We have done preliminary work on looking at the number of part-time students who will qualify for that by surveying 3 community colleges and one of Oregon's largest public 4-year colleges to assess how many of their part-time students are going to qualify. Let's see. I had a table in here someplace, but it looks like that one. I've lost that particular piece of information. But there were several qualifications that we put in place on their part-time status. First, they needed to be taking between 6 and 12 credit hours in order to qualify as a part-time student. Many of our part-time students are taking only a single class. Very few of those classes are 6-credit courses. So present data indicates that those students wouldn't qualify. We may see some change in behavior where students may choose to enroll in 2 classes that would get them to that 6-credit threshold. So we may have some increase in participation because of that. They also needed to have received a Pell Grant. Many of our part-time students make enough income that they are not qualified for the Pell Grant because of their higher number of hours that they're working, hence generally a higher income, which would disqualify them. They also need to be enrolled in a degree or certificate granting program. If I sign up to take a class at the local community college, and I'm just doing it because of an interest or a particular activity that I want to strengthen my skills in, oftentimes I will not have signed up to receive a certificate or a two-year degree. And in that instance, that student would also not be qualified unless they actually enrolled in the program. Then to move on to the last question that was posed to us last Monday, the question came around the data that we were displaying for the committee on the number of students who we had displayed data on how many students by county were receiving scholarships and the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The table under question 8 displays the number of students who in 2003-04 school year had met all of the financial and other eligibility qualifications except for the date in which they submitted their FAFSA form and hence did not receive an Oregon Opportunity Grant, but could have if we had not faced the limitation of resources that caused us to have to do cutoffs. In total, there were a little bit more than 11,000 of those students.
Mr. Bender had a question.
I was just wondering if you could please clarify for the committee. We know that for the students that are awarded the grants, approximately half or less than half actually receive them because they then enroll and remain eligible. When you are looking at these people who were financially eligible but did not receive the grant, are you also factoring that down, or is this all of the people who would have been eligible even though you don't know whether they would have eventually enrolled?
Mr. Chairman and Steve, I think the question you're asking about is a term that we refer to as the pickup rate, because there are some students who receive notice that they will receive the opportunity grant, but then choose to enroll in a school out of state or choose not to go to school, and that's caused by a variety of factors. And so not all the students offered the grant will accept the grant. No, that pickup rate factor has not been applied to these numbers. These are the students who met the financial and other qualifications for it, but whom we did not send any notice to about their eligibility.
Representative Jensen and Senator Gordley.
Can I follow on that a little bit by asking, you apparently do not contact then any of these who didn't receive notice. Is there some number or some percentage factored in originally? So to take this into consideration, to take the potential non-use into consideration to ensure that everyone, that all of those who can are...
Mr. Served. Chairman, Representative Jensen, in our projections for the 0507 Opportunity Grant Program, we have taken into account the overall pickup rate in our projections for the use of all of those resources. So we factored that in terms of how we built the 0507 budget, yes.
And you hope you haven't factored in too great a number.
Absolutely. You know, I'm looking for what I refer to as the Goldilocks budget. Not too big, not too small, just right.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. The chart that we're looking at now, I believe this responds to a question that I raised at our first meeting. And I'm trying to do a contrast with the information that you shared earlier, which is on page, I think it must be 35. It's an unnumbered 35. It's following 34. which displays the Oregon Opportunity Grants and Scholarship recipients by county. What I'm just wanting to determine if this is what you were responding to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, that is correct.
Okay. Well, I'll hold my other question, Mr. Chair. I need time to really look at this, and it's a little difficult because it's in two different pieces. I'll pass.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Gordley. Please proceed.
That is the conclusion of the specific questions. We have included, as I said, a table which shows by school the percent of FAFSA filers by paper or web-based application. And then also, further for the committee, an article that is from 2003, which talks about the student debt loads that students are encountering from the most recent national data that has come out around student borrowing patterns. With that, we would like to move on to the scholarship program this morning. As we told the committee last Monday, this is our boom season. March 1st every year is the application deadline date for students to have submitted to us their applications. On Saturday, many of us were in the Eugene offices opening literally thousands of envelopes. And having the previous year helped my daughter fill many of those envelopes, I can personally attest to the dreams and aspirations that go into every one of those envelopes as students send those off for consideration. It is a very exciting task to oversee, and it's one which we're really trying to meet the needs of students while we're balancing the requirements and requests from the donors. In doing this, we're really helping to leverage resources from the private sector that help prevent costs for us in the public sector. These donors are helping these students complete their degrees, which we all know leads to them having much, much better futures for their opportunities. And they're doing that for many students, as I said, based not just on merit, but also on need. And by doing that, it's helping to reduce the cost to the public sector and helping those students become more economically viable families. With that, I'll be glad to turn it over to Vicki Merkel to proceed through that part of the presentation.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vicki Merkel, and I'm the Grants and Scholarships Division Director, and I'm pleased to be back again this week. As you remember, we talked about the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is our state need-based grant, and how we give away lots of money through that program, and I'd like to start this morning talking about our Scholarship Services Program and how we also award students lots of money. In your handbook, you do have an application. I'm going to take just a second to talk to you about this. This is unique in the nation to have a state single application that helps scholarship donors reach thousands of students. You'll notice on the cover there is a website, and we have an electronic version of this application as well. The first step to completing the scholarship application is that FAFSA form. As Margie mentioned, there are several merit-based programs that don't require the FAFSA, but we actually like to tell students to fill out the FAFSA because we don't want people to self-select out. The computation for figuring that estimated family contribution is extremely complex, and we're afraid that people will just assume there's nothing there for them, so we encourage everyone to fill out the FAFSA form. The second is to fill out the OSEC application, which is actually, remember that FAFSA form I unfurled last time, our application is actually only just a front and back side piece of paper. But in addition to that, we ask the student to complete an activities chart, which tells us their community service school activities and work for pay, and complete two essays. We also require that they send us their transcript. So we have lots of information about the student to share with the donor. If you were doing this online, you would have a search capability to look through all the different scholarships for which you or your student might apply for. In the paper version, we have what we call the scholarship catalog. Section 1 is selected scholarships associated with specific high schools. This is a new feature this year, trying to make it easier for the student to sort and sift through more than 320 applications. And you'll see on page 8, if you choose to look in your book, that we have high schools engaged with us from Bend, Klamath Union, Lake Oswego, Portland, Marshall High School, Roseburg, and Woodburn. The second chapter is our more generic scholarships for students of all ages, abilities, accomplishments, and goals. And just a couple of, I'd like to give you a few examples of those type of scholarships. The Crossley Scholarship is for graduating seniors of an Oregon public alternative school. We have the Ford suite of scholarships. That's the Ford Family Foundation from Roseburg, Ford Scholars, Ford Opportunity Program, Ford Restart, and the Ford Sons and Daughters. We have civic groups engaged with us, the King City Lions for graduates of Tigard or Tualatin High School. The Rotary Club in Eugene has their scholarship program with us as well. And then Chapter 3 is our employer member programs, where a student qualifies because either their parent or themselves works for a certain employer or belongs to a certain organization. For example, Umatilla Electric Company has a scholarship for students through our booklet. We have partners, both large and small, who work with us as... We mentioned last time we award $10.8 million from these scholarships. Our partners include, in addition to the Ford Family Foundation, the Oregon Community Foundation, a number of banks. We work with their trust officers for donors who have set up a trust after they've passed away, employers, credit unions, utility companies, and then many, many individual donors. We also work with colleges, universities, and technical schools to disperse these dollars to their students. The next handout tells you in 2004-05, which is the current school year, how many applicants, awardees, and the total dollars awarded per school in Oregon specifically. And then at the very bottom, we've included one number for out-of-state schools. Many of our Bird Scholars go out-of-state. That's the national federal program that I'll talk about in a minute. On the back of this handout is the 03-04 comparison of scholarship and opportunity grant disbursements. We have to look back 1 year because we haven't completed awarding. Do you have the handout in your booklet? We haven't completed awarding all of the opportunity grant dollars, so we have to look back 1 year. And it's significant, I think, that our scholarship program, for example, is awarding to Oregon State University students $1,464,453. The University of Oregon students are receiving $1,115,268. And some of the smaller schools actually have students receiving more scholarship dollars from us than Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars. In addition to these private programs, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is asked to administer 9 publicly funded scholarships and other student programs that are not a good fit anywhere else. They just tend to migrate to us. These programs listed here in the top, we actually receive administrative charges to administer these programs, and these programs we do not. You have a handout next that lists a table with specific...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Could you go back to the previous slide? The jobs plus 615 participants. Could you say again what is the status of the jobs plus piece of the scholarship program? I recall hearing something in testimony about funds reverting back.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, yes, there was a one-time transfer of expired vouchers. When the potential student doesn't use their Jobs Plus voucher. It expires. And those funds were originally intended to go to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And last session, there was a decision to make a one-time return to the general fund.
And can you tell us how much that was in dollars?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe that was a little bit more than $600,000.
And those are unclaimed scholarships.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the Jobs Plus participant has up to 5 years in which to use that resource for their own education. And if it's not used at that point, then it does revert usually to the Oregon Opportunity Fund, but in that instance, instead to the general fund.
Do you have a sense of, Mr. Chair, of why such a large amount was returned?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley,
or unused?
As I understand, at the time in which the transaction occurred, it was based on a past pattern, but it was not certain that we would actually have that much in resources available. And so I think there were even some discussions about what might occur if the transfer that was directed by statute was more than what was available. Fortunately, that was not the case, and we were able to do that transfer at the beginning of this year.
And so what should we anticipate for this coming biennium as it relates to the Jobs Plus program? Where does it fit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't think we've done that calculation, but we could do that.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
I had a clarification, too. When you go back to the 320-plus scholarship programs, you may not do this given the public benefit of those programs, but do you assess any administrative charge for administering those?
Yes.
You do?
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, we do. We assess a charge on the amount of monies actually dispersed.
Do you have a clear, determination whether that assessment actually covers the cost of administering those programs?
Mr. Chair, we are working very hard in which to determine the amount in which is not covered. Generally, the direct staff who are managing those scholarship portfolios, their costs, yes, are covered. But there are certain common activities that in the past were covered much more by the allocation process through the loan program. With the discontinuation of the loan program, more of those costs now need to be attributed to the remaining pieces. And we think that there's probably somewhere between 5% and 7% of the costs that instead are being supplemental by the general fund. But in the greater scheme of things, that's a very low amount of investment for a very large return.
I would agree. But what are the general criteria in terms of someone approaching the commission wanting to start a scholarship program?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, we have donors come to us basically in two different ways. We have a partnership with the Oregon Community Foundation, and they have a cadre of donor development officers throughout the state, and this is really their strength in working with donors. If the donor has $50,000 that they would like to place in an endowment and then award scholarships on the interest, they generally go straight to the Oregon Community Foundation. If they come to us and they have that sizable amount of endowment, we will often direct them to the community foundation to set that up. If they don't, however, we will work with them to set up a scholarship. And then some donors prefer to just set up what we call a pass-through scholarship that's not connected to an endowment. And that's generally, we ask that be at least $500.
For clarification for that, those that go through the foundation, they would come back to you generally to administer?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, that's correct.
And you make the final determination on who actually receives a scholarship. correct, and you just simply do it on the basis of the criteria that the donor has identified? Or does the donor have to sign off on the final determination?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, yes. To all of that, it's done in a variety of ways. We actually, as staff, are asked by donors to choose the awardees for about 100 of our programs. We will do that either simply by using our data in-house and do a statistical analysis, or we have our own volunteers who volunteer for selection committees. The other programs, particularly through the Oregon Community Foundation, will have their own selection committees around the state. So we work with the awarding process very intensely.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Your next handout is titled OSAC Governmental Programs Disbursements Totaling $1,117,000, etc. And I'd like to just briefly go over these programs with you to show you the breadth of our public programs. The Barber and Hairdressers Program was funded in 1986. Each school receives at least one $600 award, and the criteria is the federal Pell Grant. And I apologize, the order that I'm going through is order on your handout, not on the screen. The Chafee Education and Training Scholarship for Former Foster Youth is a partnership with the Oregon Department of Human Services Independent Living Program. It serves students ages 17 to 24 who've spent at least 1 year in foster care. The Former Foster Youth State Program was not funded this biennium, so we're particularly pleased to continue to serve this this population.
This is a program that's by federal mandate that states who operate child welfare programs must operate. DHS sees the Oregon Student Assistance Commission as a key partner in administering this program to them because we can link their students much more effectively into the post-secondary education environment than what they can as a social services delivery system.
This is our one scholarship that we leave the application open all year round. As a part of our being able to serve these students in a more complete way. The third program is for students of deceased and disabled peace officers. The next program is the Deceased and Disabled Peace Officers Program. That funding does come from the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The National Guard Tuition Program. The National Guard is currently using federal funds, but we are holding a certain amount of money for them. I believe they have a bill coming in front of the legislature to use those funds for the spouse or dependent of a National Guardsman who's killed in action. The Robert Byrd Honors Program is also federal monies. We receive those via the Oregon Department of Education. This is a merit program for the top graduating students in Oregon. There are 15 awards of $15,000 per congressional district. They are renewable for 4 years. This is a very popular program. Last year, we were in danger of not being able to do this because we don't receive any administrative costs to run this program. It's nearly $500,000. My staff and I looked at this and said, we can't let this $500,000 go away. And so we changed the way we did the awarding process. Instead of having a selection committee where we had to pay expenses for folks to come in and spend a couple days and read through the applications, we went to a statistical analysis. So we were able to make all of these awards last year, and I'm very proud of my staff for coming up with that innovative idea.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Did you mean to skip over the one after the National Guard, the Oregon Opportunity Grant?
I'm using the
The page in your notebook after that one. Oh, okay. Looks like this is the.
Thank you.
The Oregon Nursing Services Program is a repayment program designed to increase the number of registered nurses working in critical nursing shortage areas, which are either a geographic area or a practice specialty. Rural Health is also a loan repayment program that serves physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who practice in a rural area, and those areas are defined by the Office of Rural Health. Completing their service are currently paying back, we are paying 28 medical doctors, 11 physician assistants, and 15 nurse practitioners in qualifying areas. The next program, the Jobs Plus program, is offered currently by the Department of Employment. These are, again, our recently laid off workers who have been placed at participating employers. Those employers contribute $1 per hour that can later be used by the employee or a member of their family. I did want to mention in response to our earlier question that there was a change recently in order to encourage the families to use more of these dollars. It was a decision was made that these dollars could use for a dependent of the employee. The dollars can be used to pay for classes or training, but two-thirds of these vouchers are redeemed at Oregon two-year and four-year public institutions. The Oregon Youth Conservation Program is for students who become eligible for a one-time $15,000 scholarship when they complete a full year in the Community Service Corps program. Then we have four repayment or loan forgiveness programs that have no new activity. There are no new students entering these programs, but we continue to have to use staff time to administer the collections. Now, these loans have nothing to do with the type of loans that OSAC recently transitioned out of. These are specifically targeted loan forgiveness or loan repayment programs. We also encourage employers to use the employer tax credit program. These are for businesses with 4 to 250 employees, and they can receive 50 cents on the dollar for a scholarship that they would set up. In 2001, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission was named National Scholarship Provider of the Year for our outreach efforts. As Margie mentioned in her answers to questions, she actually went over the type of outreach that we do, so I won't go over that again. We also, with our unified application, are providing services not only to the student, because for it's easier to fill out one application than 320 separate ones, but it provides the donors a breadth of applicant pool that would be very difficult for them to reach on their own. We also have the fun of sending out the award notification letters and getting those thank yous back. It's fun to hear from an 18-year-old student who goes, yeah, I received a reward or encouragement. But it's really, really great to read the letters from the graduating students who look back and say, oh, gosh, that really made a difference for me. That's the reason I was able to attend school, the reason that I persisted. We have an ongoing process where we continue to work with donors, as Margie also mentioned in her answers, when they're not seeing the type of student that they really want their monies to go to. We work with them to broaden the applicant pool. We do the needs analysis for our need-based scholarships. Most of our scholarships are what I would call merit within need. First, we're looking at the student's need. We look at their need differently than we do in the opportunity grant. We gather from the schools the cost of attendance. And then we use our FAFSA data to determine the estimated family contribution and other public awards that the student would receive to come out with the sum of what the student's need will be. So scholarship donors are looking at need, which will vary, of course, depending on the school that the student will attend. And the student tells us that on the application. We ask them to tell us the school they're planning on attending, they're currently attending, or are most likely to attend. So it's very important that they understand that. We provide assistance to those selection committees that I mentioned. We provide them with training and staff support to ensure that they are following the donor's intent and they understand privacy laws. We do fund accounting, and then, of course, we're transferring the monies to the schools. Our scholarship services manager, Alan Boss, likes to talk about the watering hole concept, that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission Scholarship Program is really a place where all of these folks can come together in order to serve students. The students themselves are families, donors. We provide a lot of information directly to high school counselors and teachers about our scholarship process and applying for scholarships in general. And, of course, we work very directly with the college financial aid offices. We have four seasons to scholarships. Preparing happens in the fall, where we continually update our scholarships. Once a donor contacts us, we actually have a set of administrative rules that we have to put in place for that scholarship, and a trust agreement if the monies are being transferred to us, or the Oregon Community Foundation will do that. In the winter, we ship over 30,000 paper applications out to high schools and colleges around the state, recognizing that not everyone has access to a computer or is comfortable with that. We continue to make the paper applications widely available. They also go out to nonprofit agencies and that request them or that we think would be a good match for us. This year, the electronic e-app went live right before the holiday break. Then, in my pretend world, the students are spending their holiday break filling out scholarship applications. We provide throughout the state, through Aspire, and I have three scholarship consultants who are former counselors who went to colleges also and communities and presented our workshop called Scholarship Search, Apply, and Compete. It's also open to the public. Even in an Aspire school, our staff will have one presentation in the afternoon for students, and then they'll do a community-wide presentation in the evening. Because part of our linkage between the scholarship program, Aspire, and our donors is, again, bringing that breadth of students to the applicant pool. We also, our websites are public, and we offer lots of information on all of our websites for the public. Right now, as Margie mentioned, we're processing those tubs and tubs of mail that come in to us. We follow a very clearly the deadline. It's an absolute deadline of March 1. This is to create a level playing field for the donor, so they understand that we are the disinterested third party. And I just used to really enjoy talking to high school students. I did that for 6 years, and making sure they understood if their scholarship application came in on March 2nd, if it was postmarked March 2nd, they weren't in the ball game. They couldn't play. They were absolutely shocked. You know, I said, it's not like a teacher that maybe you can convince to accept your lay paper. We don't. It's an absolute deadline. Now, if there's a extenuating circumstances, we do have an appeal process. We found, particularly with electronics, so once in a while someone will, of course, gone on at 11:45 at night and wasn't able to somehow make their browser work or something, and then they can write me a letter. But when we're processing and reviewing these 10,000 packets, we are trying to create that level playing field. And then in the summer is when we are doing our awarding. We try and get all of our high school scholarships awarded before graduation night. That's always our goal, because high schools like to know that information so they can surprise their students on award night. And then we're busy dispersing the funds directly to the colleges. The scholarship programs have grown, as you can see on this page, from 116 to more than 320. The Ford Family Foundation scholarships, we work a little bit differently with the Ford Family Foundation than we used to. They incubated their programs at OSAC, and then they grew up and left the nest, and they now have an office across the street. They rely on us very heavily. They come over during scholarship season and appreciate us just being across the street from them so that they can come over and review the 6,000 or 7,000 applicants for their scholarships. That way we don't have privacy issues of taking those applications off-site. And they work with us on a contract basis. The next handout, the colorful one, is the one we use in our outreach efforts to talk to students and their families about how to get college funds. And then, should you be interested, there's more information on the whole processing. I'll move on to the Aspire program. Aspire?
We do have one question. Representative March.
Thank you. It just kind of struck me as you were talking and about letting the high schools know so they could kind of present that as a surprise. Does that create the perception that the high school was granting that and it wasn't OSAC?
Chair Devlin and Representative March, it probably, usually it will be presented from the donor, that the donor was the person awarding the scholarship.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a document or a brochure or something like this for the Jobs Plus program?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, we have a one-page handout, but we, for administrative costs, we've sort of stopped sending that around.
does the employment department have its own brochure or process then?
Well, I'd have to look into that.
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of stuck on the Jobs Plus program this morning because I'm troubled by what I heard earlier and what I've heard before, that this large sum of money reverts back to the general fund. And as I understand it was $600,000 last time around. So that leads me to question what kind of outreach is going on. I'm questioning the effectiveness of the outreach. Would like to know more about what that looks like. And then if we have that much money that isn't being used, why the general fund? Why not put it into more opportunity grants? Those questions come to mind.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be glad to come back with information in phase two that would respond to what the outreach is between the two different agencies. And I think even DHS plays some partnership role in the program as well.
And, so. I'd like to know if that discussion has taken place somewhere. I have a vague recollection that it has about rather than the funds, unused funds, reverting back to general fund, putting those funds into the opportunity grant.
I think that Mr. Bender may have an answer for that question, the last question. So.
Senator and members, typically the unused funds do go to the opportunity grant. This biennium was a one-time exception when last session the legislature, because of the state's budget situation, looked at moving various other fund balances and transferring those to the general fund. And this was just a component of that transfer of many different types of other funds to the general fund to help balance the budget this biennium.
Can we clarify that when that action was taken, that there was no change in the statute? Because I assume it's the statute that actually dictates that unspent funds would go back to the opportunity grants rather than to the general fund.
I will clarify that for you.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
That begs the question as to whether the funds set aside for this biennium are going to go back to the opportunity grant program if they're not used by the Jobs Plus program. And that would sort of tie back to your question about whether that was a statutory change.
Mr. Chair, because that transaction was very recent, I reviewed all of the statutes in terms of how it was constructed to do that during the current biennium. It was a notwithstanding clause that was built into a bill that was only in effect for this current biennium. So the other language will be what it reverts to that will cause the funds, if unobligated in the Jobs Plus program, to instead to be deposited in the opportunity grant forthwith, as long as there isn't some other statutory impediment.
So, Mr. Chair, yes. I'm still a bit confused, and I really appreciate Senator Gordley's question. Are these monies from the Jobs Plus program, are any of that being used to calculate the governor's budget in terms of the opportunity grant? Did he build his budget on any of the money in the Jobs Plus program for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no. The Jobs Plus reversion was not a part of the calculations in terms of estimating the amount of resources. There were estimates made in terms of the lottery funds that would be available and the funds coming from the education stabilization resource that are built into it, but not from the Jobs Plus program.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, yes. But I need to stick with this. Historically, how much money from the Jobs Plus program has reverted back to the general fund over, say, the last 10 years? I mean, I don't know when we implemented the Jobs Plus program.
Or Senator Walker, normally they would have reverted to the opportunity grant.
I mean, so that's what I meant.
Yeah. How much has...
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I don't have that historical data, but we'd be glad to provide that when we come back phase two.
Yeah, and the reason I'm asking is because I want to know if we don't use that money, how much we'll have left to use in the opportunity grant program for this biennium. but also probably getting to the first question that Senator Gorley raised, is why isn't the Jobs Plus program using the money in the first instance?
We'll be glad to come back and respond to the whole series of questions. Some of that may be just the stressors in those families. If you're trying to raise a family and hold down a full-time job, the ability to take supplemental classes is daunting for all of us, but I would assume particularly for low-income families.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
That's what I'm questioning. I don't want us to make assumptions, and I mean that with all due respect. We really need to unpack what is going on there. We have this almost decade-long history now, maybe it's a little bit more than that, with the Jobs Plus program. And so this is a good time to ask the question, how is it working? Is it working? The strategies around outreach to make sure that Jobs Plus clientele even know that the opportunity exists, what does that look like? Just a lot of unpacking of our assumptions, ours as committee members, and all the other assumptions that exist out there around the program.
Well, with that, I guess you will get back to us with information about the what is being done in terms of utilization of the dollars, in terms of informing people of the availability, and you'll probably also work with Mr. Bender to determine what the history of this has been. Mr. Bender tells me on average about $300,000 has reverted to the opportunity grants in previous financings. I would remind the committee that we've become very adept at finding little sources of money that we can use for other things. So we should probably be on guard during this session, because anytime anything's identified as being a leftover balance, there might be other parties that will see that as a potential opportunity, not to use any pun. And so we should probably be on guard if our interest is seeing that those dollars actually either revert to the opportunity grants, or maybe in some regards are better utilized by those parties that they were originally set aside for. So with that, we will proceed to Aspire.
Another potential recipient of those funds.
Whenever I talk about Aspire, I like to explain what the name stands for. It's actually an acronym. Access to Student Assistance Programs is the first half of the Aspire word. By that, we very purposefully mean that Aspire is intended to work with students and their desires to go to all types of post-secondary education. We do not channel or direct students into a four-year degree or a two-year degree or a tech voc school. We look at the student, what their interests are, and what type of school might be the best fit for them. The second part of the name is in reach of everyone. Aspire is an all-comers program. Anyone in an Aspire high school may sign up to have an Aspire advisor. My research when I started designing this program showed that students who are in the middle are the least likely to go. And by the middle, I mean those mid-range students, not the high achievers who are most likely to get the attention of the high school counselor, and not the students who may qualify for a TRIO or Garrett program, a type of program where they're receiving direct assistance, but those kids in the middle who maybe whose families hadn't gone to college. By making this an all-comers program, we're able to not only serve everyone, but to sort of, you know, gather in all the students who may not believe that they can continue their education. The first goal is to provide the one-on-one assistance, or it's a targeted mentoring program. This is not a big brother, big sister type of mentoring. The volunteers are trained to give specific information, work on specific topics of access with the student. The student comes and has issues around their boyfriend or their family. We train the advisor to then send the student to the counselor. We help high schools build a sustainable community of volunteers. Currently, high school counselors average a student load of 450 students. One counselor to 450 students. Now, when I was in high school, what I think my counselors were mostly worrying about was the length of the boys' hair and the length of the girls' skirts, and that was kind of about it. But now, many decades later, problems are much different for students. The counselors are having to actually do, I think, a lot of social services type counseling regarding the difficulties of young people today. We also found that high schools traditionally do not use volunteers outside of, say, the sports or drama activities. So we have to had to encourage the administration to be more receptive to having parent volunteers in their high schools on campus. And then our third goal is to educate those students and families about the scholarship application process and other options for paying for school. Your next handout is the Aspire brochure, and this is used for recruiting volunteers and for explaining to families about the program. Aspire brings together both the students, the school staff, volunteers, and parents with the goal of helping overcome obstacles. By providing the mentoring and training and encouragement, we hope all students, particularly those from low-income families and those who are first generation, will continue their education. Recently, there was a cartoon, and it was for better or for worse, and I couldn't get copyright privileges to be able to hand it out, so I'll just describe it to you. The daughter of the family's gone up to teach in the very northlands of Canada, and she's talking with a community member who's her principal, and he's talking about how he had the funds to go to college, and so one of his neighbors says, "Oh, that must have made it easy." He said, "It wasn't the money, it was the confidence that made it difficult and challenging for me." And I think what Aspire does is the very difficult job of helping to instill confidence in that elusive term that we use so much in social services is self-esteem. You can't buy that. You can only give it one-on-one.
I'll stop here for a moment. Ms. Lowe, we have about 50 minutes left. Can you sort of time the rest of your presentations? Because we have to get to the performance and priority list before we close today. And we do not have this agency scheduled for tomorrow, so we actually have to finish today. So
I'll do it. Please.
Talk fast.
Talk very fast and very briefly here. Aspire advisors meet with 1 to 10 students, and they serve an average of 2 to 4 years. Aspire Ingenuity was originally a private public partnership with the Oregon Community Foundation. We did a 3-year pilot program to design a program that could work in any type of high school in the state. The original impetus for Aspire was that scholarship program. Donors wanted to see more mid-range students, more boys, and more students of diversity. So we figured we would have to go out in the schools and actually recruit those students. We are currently receiving in-kind from OSAC for space and accounting services, that sort of thing, but actual program cash dollars come from our funding partners listed here, and I'll just skip over those four to save time. We currently have 668 adults volunteering. You have a handout here that shows the types of statistics that we gather on the Aspire program. Now I'm trying to go fast. I'm just stumbling my words. I apologize. In 2004-05, 4,381 students received one-on-one mentoring. One unintended outcome of bringing Aspire into the school, though, that we quickly realized is there was information being given to students that hadn't otherwise been presenting. So we started tracking the number of non-mentored services. And if you look down the column, you'll see the thousands of students that receive newsletters, go to a workshop, and my favorite statistic here are the tag-along students, the student who doesn't sign up for an Aspire advisor themselves, but if you've had teenagers yourself, you know that they sort of move around in little pods or little gaggles. And we started tracking this because at Malala High School, there was a friend of a mentee who tagged along. The school district superintendent happened to be the Aspire advisor, and being a good Aspire advisor gave both girls the scholarship application. The girl who was tagging along as the friend became a Ford Scholar. These charts show the volunteer growth in the program, and the vast increase between 02 and 03 is due to the increase in the AmeriCorps program. For the same reason that that counselors have trouble meeting the needs of students, they were also having difficulty recruiting that first core of volunteers. So we have an AmeriCorps grant that we now receive through a national competition. We have 40 members that we place in the schools initially to help implement the program. The more volunteers we have, of course, the more students we can mentor. This is a map of where the Aspire schools are located throughout the state. And if anyone in the room should like to volunteer for the Aspire program, you simply call the school and ask for the Aspire advisor. We have 59 high schools, and we are right now, at the end of this week, we'll be publicizing our request for proposal. High schools apply and compete for the program. They do not have to pay for it directly. They receive training and technical assistance from us. There is a small charge to them to cover part of the AmeriCorps member's cost if they should have an AmeriCorps member. We have a website that is offers resources for everyone in the program. And before I go to this page, I have a handout, and I'm going to do this really quickly, but with the Aspire program, I have success stories here for you. I just have to tell you just a couple of our stories here about students. These were not gathered for your benefit. We just occasionally go out and we ask our schools for success stories. Ashland High School is reporting that they, at their OSAC Scholarship Search Apply and Compete presentation, they had the largest turnout of parents and students of any college presentation to date. And they attribute that to the program being part of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and the credibility that we maintain. Chiloquin High School, the AmeriCorps member writes, she's working with three young men who never considered college seriously before this year. They're facing down their disadvantages, the low GPA, extreme poverty at home, peer pressure to just stay around and hang out. One of these young men told her that he wants to be a teacher someday, and her heart grew a size. McKinsey High School, there's a little two-paragraph story here that I want to share with you, because it's so well written. The volunteer writes, I'd like to share one story with you that may not seem like a huge success, but it's an ongoing process that I have very high hopes for. In October, I had a student come into my office, flop down into a chair, look me right in the eye and say, I have a 1.27 GPA. Can I go to college? Without even thinking, I said, absolutely. Then I did the math in my head and knew that this kid would have to do some serious turnaround work to survive in college. Since then, he's come into my office daily to check in and get a piece of candy and say, I'm going to college and I'm counting on you. I'm reminded every day how important my job is. I've given him buckets and buckets of encouragement and candy, and I've also reminded him I will match the effort he puts into the process. Yesterday afternoon, he came into my office, the familiar flop into a chair, well-choreographed candy grab on the way down, looked me right in the eye and said, I'm here to fill out applications. I brought a pen. We sat there for hours, checking in with each of his teachers, letting them know why he wasn't in class, of course. When we got his LCC application mailed, he also filled out the OSAC and LCC scholarship applications and started on his essays. He says he's going to Last Chance College, which is LCC. If you live in Lane County, the kids will say that. But I'm really proud of him for doing this, and I know he's proud of himself also. The last story I want to share with you is Springfield High School. A student named Gina began meeting with her Aspire advisor, Haley, in her senior year. And Gina was a good student who knew she wanted to go into school but didn't know how to pay for it. Through the efforts of the Aspire advisor, she's now applied for more than 30 scholarships.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the grants and scholarships section of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We'll then move on to the Office of Degree Authorization. That office is staffed by Alan Contreras, who's the administrator.
I always hate coming right after Vicki because of her burning enthusiasm for the Aspire program, which is really a wonderful program. I'm Alan Contreras, the administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. Mr. Chairman, in light of your comments about time, I'm going to give you the very quick version and let you have any questions that you might have. We call the Office of Degree Authorization ODA for convenience, so that's what I will call it. It has one very substantial function, and that is to evaluate and approve any new colleges or new college degree programs from private and out-of-state schools, most of them that want to start up in the state of Oregon. That is entirely supported by applicant fees, and there's no general fund in that function. There has been a very substantial increase in the past half a dozen years in the number of schools that want to operate in Oregon, particularly in the Portland area, and in the number of programs that they want to offer. Examples of these would be the University of Phoenix, ITT Technical, Western Culinary, Embry-Riddle Aeronautical. There's quite a number of them. The other significant ODA function is to deal with the increasing problem of the availability of fake and substandard degrees, which used to be the things you'd see advertised on matchbook covers, and now they've graduated to the internet. There's so many of them now, there's a new book that's out called Degree Mills. I think I sent a copy to Mr. Bender, if any of you want to see it, written by a former FBI agent who was responsible for investigating some of these problems with people buying and selling degrees. One of our functions is to make sure that these degrees do not get used in Oregon as credentials without our dealing with those in a manner to make sure the public is aware of the problem. Those are the two major ODA functions. In addition, ODA has the role of mediating and resolving occasional disputes among the different sectors of post-secondary education in Oregon, the community colleges, the four-year publics, and the private colleges. Under Oregon law, when a public college wants to start a new degree program, private colleges that offer similar programs in similar geographic areas have a right to object, and then there is a procedure through which everyone goes to try to resolve the difficulty, and ODA is the agency that oversees that procedure. We have an advisory committee, which is made up of former Vice Chancellor Shirley Clark, some of you know, Gary Andine from the Independent Colleges Association, several other college leaders from from around the state. And that's really the basics of ODA and what it does and how it operates. The main issues that we have faced are that there are so many more schools that want to come to Oregon now and want to offer more programs. That is less a problem for us than for some agencies because they are all paying an application fee, and that is how we fund the evaluation and review process that they go through. And I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee may have.
Representative Wisnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, to save time, I won't ask it to be responded to now, but I think that we need to look into this multiple function of Office of Degree Authorization, and that seems very important, but I don't understand why it's under this organization, and I don't understand how two people can do that. That seems like something that would be beneficial to all of our students and colleges. I don't know how it's organization of two, so maybe in the next phase we can get into more detail. I think that's a responsibility we might want to look at. How can we better support it, because it seems like it is of importance to our educational system, but I don't understand how two people can do all this we're talking about here and also do that and how they interact. So I won't ask for a question, but just be sure that we don't, Mr. Bender, again, that it be addressed in phase two. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional question, probably to follow up on also, what criteria you utilize in new programs that are coming to the state and evaluating, their quality and whether or not they'll be authorized. And just a little bit of a question maybe you could respond to now is that in this era of competition where we've asked our university system to be more competitive, and many of them have actually developed satellite campuses in other university territory, so to speak. Have you been drawn into any of those battles?
Mr. Chairman, on several occasions, people have tried to draw us into those battles, and we have very politely said that we have problems that we're supposed to deal with, and that is not one of them. The way the law is written, disputes between public sector institutions That is to say, two different community colleges poaching on each other's territory in the Portland area, for example. They have called us and asked us if we can help resolve that. We do not have the jurisdiction to do that. That is belongs to the commissioner's office, Cam Brawley's office, and I happily send them all to talk to Cam. So that it's been tried, but it has not been tried successfully.
Well, thank you very much for that presentation. And
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I want to cover briefly the remaining parts of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and that is the administration and information technology staff. As we discussed last Monday, the agency's gone through quite a downsizing experience in the last 3 years with the struggles of the loan program and its privatization. Yeah, overall, in administration and information technology, there have been 8 positions that have been eliminated in this area, leaving at this point 4. The executive director position, support staff person that supports all of the activities of the commission and does a lot of support functions for the overall agency, and then 2 fiscal staff, a fiscal analyst, 3 who does all of the accounting, financial statements and budget work for the agency, and an accounting technician who takes care of payroll and billing services. Our HR services, human resource services, will be done in partnership with the Department of Administrative Services Human Resources Division. In the area of information technology, as you can imagine, it takes a very effective technology system in order to handle those 10,000 scholarship applications that come in each year, in addition to the literally tens of thousands of students who apply for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. These programs don't work if the systems that support them don't work. This is an important function of the agency, and in the past, more of its costs were allocated to the loan program. This is an area where you will find that there is general fund supporting the work of both the Opportunity Grant and the scholarship programs, because in the past, more of those costs could be absorbed by the loan program. The agency is in the process of doing a top-to-bottom review of all of its expenditures. I think I mentioned on the first day we were here that usually when we do budget projections, we're relying on the most recent history in which to build the future projections. We don't have the benefit of having a clear picture from our most recent history because it still has loan transaction costs embedded in it. So we are having to tease those costs out and then to look to see what the remainder is. And that will be information that we bring back to the committee through the revised process with the governor's office at phase 2 of our discussion. The technology services for the agency presently are on 2 different platforms, an AS400, as well as web-based applications. During the next 2 years, we will be migrating off of that AS400. It was owned, that particular machine is owned 100% by the loan program. And so I had some nervousness when I discovered that Uncle Sam actually owned a piece of equipment that I rely on vitally in order to take care of the work of the agency. But it does help illustrate how heavily reliant OSAC has been on the resources of the loan program in the last decade. And much of that was, as I understand, because of the constraints on the state's general fund. The agency was urged, wherever possible, to assign those costs to other funds' revenues. So I would urge the committee to be somewhat cautious as you approach those types of deliberations, that sometimes we may create some frailty in other parts of our system when we do that. We are looking carefully at our revenues as well as our expenditures because we want to make sure that the agency is going to be in a very stable situation. Again, that just right budget for the 05-07 biennium. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about what the particulars are around the technology services. I think you have a sense of that from just understanding how important it is in basically processing those thousands of pieces of paper that have a lot to do with students' futures, and wanting to make sure that that system effectively supports those services. In addition to the services that we use in-house, one of the functions that had been developed by the agency in the last several years in conjunction as a marketing tool for the loan program to the various schools that it was serving through the loan program was a service called OFAX. This is actually an application that we do in support of schools who have co-enrollment types of functions. For example, the Oregon State University and Limbetton Community College have a lot of students who are taking classes simultaneously at both institutions, some of them all in Corvallis, some of them in Albany and Corvallis. It's important for that student's financial aid picture to take into account all of the credits that it's earning and the financial support that it's receiving from either school. OFAX is basically a matching service where we combine records from both institutions so that they can identify that mutual population that they have of interest and can match those records. It simplifies things for the student's financial aid process and also simplifies the activity for those schools. This is a service that we do not because it actually benefits anything that we do at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, but rather as a service to those schools. We had a meeting with a few of those school representatives last Friday. They are very interested in the function continuing. Its actual resident location is something that we're open to discussing with all of those institutions. I will say that many of those institutions, as we got further into the discussion, started to express the need for wherever that location to be one that is extremely impartial. As I'm sure some of you are aware, there's a fair amount of competition that goes on between each of the sectors and among the sectors in the post-secondary education environment. And they always are very sensitive to anything that might give one a perceived or actual advantage over one in another part of the system. So with that, I'd like to move on to the benchmarks and the performance measures for OSAC, if the committee has any questions on administration or IT.
Please proceed.
Okay. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission links to three benchmarks, all of them having to do with post-secondary education for Oregonians. The first benchmark is that for those who have completed some college. Then benchmark number 25 for those that have post-secondary professional or technical credentials. And then benchmark number 26, the percentage of Oregon students or adults who completed a bachelor's degree and also advanced degrees. In addition to that, we think we have a strong secondary link to benchmark number 30, the percent of Oregonians who volunteer at least 50 hours of their time per year to civic, community, or nonprofit activities. As many of you are aware, our young people have become very active community citizens. It is a very key link for many of them in terms of their receiving scholarship opportunities. And in addition to that, we have a tremendous cadre of volunteers who help support us in carrying out those scholarship programs. The agency in the past had a series of performance measures that had to do with the Opportunity Grant. And these are ones that we have been reworking. And so I want to just touch briefly on these before we go into how we would propose to change them for the 05-07 biennium and beyond. The first was the percent of eligible students who were awarded an Oregon Opportunity Grant. This was a performance measure that, in fact, the last legislature asked us to reexamine and to retool, and that will be discussed later. The second is the grant dollars that are awarded per FTE student in Oregon compared to its counterparts across the country. Again, the committee was interested in there being a revised approach to this one. And thirdly, the percent of growth in the number of scholarships that are awarded in Oregon. Then we come to that fuzzy page, and it is a clearer copy further on in the document, so I'll just skip by that. The committee would consider that. And move into more how we're reviewing and revising our performance measures. In the Oregon Opportunity Grant, we're going to be measuring its success in the future by looking at how the grant allow students to persist in getting their education. The number of students who re-enroll, re-engage in education from year to year, and then the number who are actually able to complete the degree that they started on. One of the things that we found in our loan program is that our students who don't complete their degrees have a much higher default rate, and we would see that as probably an indicator of a lot of other challenges that they face. They've had the added cost of trying to get their education, but in not completing it, they still have that obligation to take care of, but without the credential that would help them earn the income to do that. Very important. Also, the race and ethnicity of our recipients is an area that the committee had asked us to look at specifically last biennium, as well as the administrative efficiency in the program. In our scholarship services, we're also looking for administrative efficiency. As we covered those programs this morning, you saw a wide diversity in terms of the criteria in what those programs look like. And that variety is in some ways a strength, but also a weakness. The more variation that we have, the more challenges that gives us in terms of managing each one of those scholarship loans within a portfolio. Those separate distinctions require all specific modifications and extra staff intervention. That adds cost. So we're going to be looking at ways in which we can create more commonality in the application processing functions as well as the application form itself. We're there on the application form. We need it now more on the application review and evaluation. We also continue to want to stress the number of scholarships and the dollar growth, that we think this is a very important function which helps relieve pressure on students and the general fund. And again, the race and ethnicity of the recipients is an important way for us to look at this. We think it's important that we not look at set benchmarks in terms of the awarding, but rather set benchmarks more on the outreach and application side of the process, that there will be a number of legal difficulties that the agency will encounter if we target particular award levels. And we'd like to keep the resources going to students going to school rather than the legal review of that process. In the Aspire program, our performance measures will have to do with the number of high school students who receive post-secondary information each year. I think you've seen some tremendous growth in that program this morning, and we would hope to be able to continue to expand that.
Excuse me.
Yes, Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Both Representative Wisnett and I thought that another portion of that would be the percent of those who you do give the post-secondary information that do go on. So how successful you are at Aspire is the measure there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, duly noted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Under the scholarship services and looking at the bullet scholarship number and dollar growth, has there been discussion at all around a measure that targets or that is focused on the type of scholarship? For example, what is behind my question is knowing that we need more nurses, we need more teachers of special education, we need more teachers of foreign language, and on down the line. Has there been any discussion around a performance measure that is also tied to trying to increase the number of professionals in categories where we are sorely deficient as a state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, you raise, I think, an important way for us to look at how we would target our activities related to scholarship development. And I think that is something that we could do effectively with, for example, the Workforce Investment Council and the folks at the Employment Department, as well as our partners in higher education, so that we can do hopefully more things to financially support the students who are going into those areas where Oregon has gaps between the folks we have who could do the work and the amount of work that needs to be done. So we'll certainly be glad to look at that.
I appreciate that. We need alignment in our activities and strategies. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last, within the Office of Degree Authorization, our performance measure presently, and when we would propose to continue, it has to do with the median months that it takes to complete the review of those new degree authorizing programs across the state. With that, I would like to move on to the actual performance measures themselves so that you can have a chance to see some of the, I always consider a picture to be worth more than 1,000 words, actually. And so we can go through those so you can see some of the preliminary data that we have. Many of these are brand new measures, and so we do not have a series of years, but rather a start to building these new measures. Within the Opportunity Grant Program, this first chart shows you the data in terms of the race and ethnicity by college segment of the students who are recipients of the grant. The dark color bar are the community college recipients. The gray shaded bar is the recipients in Oregon's public four-year universities. And then the white bar is the Oregon population number overall. As you can see, we are generally, I think I want to do a little explanation first. We have these two areas under unknown. Race and ethnicity information is voluntarily provided by the student on their college application. OSAC itself does not get any information directly from the students as they file the FAFSA. That is not data collected on the FAFSA form. So this information comes to us by doing file matches with these different educational sectors. So as you can see, we have a fair amount of variation between the different sectors, but I would say the area where we're probably most underrepresented in the Opportunity Grant Program is in the Hispanic population.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This information is also 5 years old.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, this information was done based on a sample that we used in order to look at student degree completion information. So that's the reason why the datedness of this data. In the future, it will be much more current as we're able to actually do all of this matching between the different resources.
So the data is 5 years old.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
How soon would we expect to see data that is more current taking us up and through 2004?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, we need to do the sample selection, and we then need to look to the community colleges and the OUS system to be able to provide us with the data that, because they're the only part of the system that has the race and ethnicity information. So it's a matter of the staff resources to be able to do it on both our side and in those two post-secondary sectors. So I would hope that we could have it even when we come back for phase two, but it is scholarship season and our staff are kind of right up here on paperwork otherwise.
Well, I just want us to be clear that we're looking at information that's 5 years old, and that's problematic. So,
well, I do believe you'll have some of the new data when you come back in phase two. This, you said, was generated for purposes of degree completion. So,
yes, Mr. Chairman, as we move on to the other charts, you'll be able to see how we're then tracking this same population through the years in terms of the other performance measures within the program. This chart shows for students who are enrolled in four-year colleges in Oregon what their persistence rate is, and this is really kind of a proxy data for calculating that persistence, because the only way in which we have to track that is that students continuing to do the annual FAFSA application form. That tells us that they are planning to re-enroll in the subsequent year. And so as you can see, what we've taken here is data from students who received the opportunity grant and compared it with that population of folks who met the financial qualifications but did not meet the time qualifications for their submission of their FAFSA to pick up the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So we're comparing like financial populations and looking at their subsequent processes for refiling the FAFSA from 1 year to the next. You can see that there's a 40% difference over those years. We've looked at a six-year horizon here because in the post-secondary world, particularly with students taking programs that take longer for them to complete, the higher education generally looks at a six-year completion process for degree completion. So this is showing you how many of those students are hanging in there from 1 year to the next and comparing recipients of the grant and non-recipients.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gorley.
Again, this data would be more useful. It needs to be unpacked. The percentage of applicants has more meaning if we know what the numbers are behind the percentages. And then within those numbers, disaggregating those numbers, gender, race, ethnicity, also gives us a more complete picture of what it is you're trying to tell us here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I would love to be able to give you that disaggregated data down by race and ethnicity, but the challenge we have is that to do the file matching is an expensive process for us when we look at degree completion because we have to go to a national data bank where it costs us 25 cents per record. So this information is based on a sample, and I'm afraid that sample would have very small numbers when it came to some of the smaller subsets of the population. It would probably not be statistically significant data.
I don't know that I can accept that. I'm also raising a question around the percentage of applicants. Rather than just displaying percentage of applicants, I'm asking for actual numbers of applicants.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, we'd certainly be glad to provide you with actual numbers that are behind this data.
Mm-hmm.
We have that, but again, I worry that the different racial segments will probably be very small parts of the sample.
Yes. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understand what it is you're really trying to portray with the graph that you have. What is there that would motivate me as a student after I have been turned down to reapply in 99-00 or in 2000-01.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, although you were turned down for an Oregon Opportunity Grant, based on the timeline, in all probability, probably 95% probability, you were the recipient of a federal Pell Grant. And in order to have your Pell Grant renewed next year, you would need to still complete the FAFSA each year. So you would be motivated by probably up to $4,000 of federal assistance, even if you had not received that assistance from the state.
Okay. But what is it? I'm still grasping it, trying to figure out what you're trying to show us here, and what type of meaning I can, get out of that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I think the meaning is that for a relatively modest sum of money, $1,200 to $1,500 grant, these students are hanging in there and sticking with working on their education. That many times I think the committee has pondered, does that amount of grant make a difference in these students' lives? And I think this data helps you understand that, yes, it does. And as we move on to this chart, you can see it in an even more marked way, where you can see these are the differences in the degree completion rates for students in the three sectors. Again, comparing the same population, but looking at how many of those actually get the certificate or the degree that they started out to earn in that time period, you can see 15 to 20% higher performance by those students who were Opportunity Grant recipients compared to their counterparts who were receiving federal assistance and maybe some institutional assistance, but unfortunately could not get the Opportunity Grant.
I just
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Brian Klim. I'm the chair of the Student Assistance Commission. And the thing that the number says to me, just from a pure layman, you know, who was just over at a pear hearing because I'm trying to get my farm to have the state fruit, so I'm not following data very closely right now. You have the question, are these students going to go to college anyway? And should we even bother giving them a grant? Because are they going to go anyway? Is there enough tuition at a low enough rate? Is there enough federal programs? And so what we tried to do is say, let's figure out who got the grant and who tried to get it but failed because we ran out of money, and see at what rate they went on to college. And the question is, did that $1,200 grant cause them to go? And in this chart, you're seeing all other factors the same. They got other aid. They got their applications in. They were accepted by the universities. And they failed to get one grant because we ran out of money. And you have 40% increase in re-enrollment because they were able to get the grant than if they missed the deadline. And I guess what we're trying to say, and what this governor's saying to you, is you have an opportunity to solve that problem in his budget. It's to say, well, there will be no deadline. That when they go and show up, that they're going to get their grant and they're going to be able to complete and turn around the Oregon economy.
Mr. Chairman, some of these cutoff dates occur as early as the middle of March. And so it's not a matter that these students weren't interested, weren't committed. They just were unaware. And we, in fact, do not publish what the cutoff dates are, because if we did, then we'd have more students apply earlier, and that would then force us to move the cutoffs even earlier in the process, given our current resource constraint. So it becomes a very vicious cycle of the earlier people apply, the earlier we have to turn the program off because we limit out on the resources. We hope to not have to do that in the 0507 budget, and the governor's budget would make that happen.
Mr. Chair, I am still not convinced that there's any significant meaning to these charts. But I will meditate on it for a while, and we'll be back with this some other time in the not too distant future.
Okay, please proceed.
To move on, Mr. Chair, next we'd like to look at the percentage growth in the number of privately funded scholarships that are awarded. My apologies, Senator Gordley, this is, again, percentage data. We'd be glad to get the specific underlying numbers behind these graphs for the committee. You can see that there has been considerable growth in the number of scholarships that are funded by the private sector over recent years, and we would hope to be able to expand that. Our technology is somewhat of our limiting factor right now, and we would hope to be able to, as we do that platform migration off of the AS400, be able to be even more efficient in overseeing the programs. In the scholarship category, this pie chart shows the race and ethnicity of the last complete year's data that we have, which is for 2003-04. You can see that we have a strong participation across all of the sectors, but then even more encouraging than that is the percentage of awards that are awarded by gender and race. When we ran this data, we were delighted to see that across all sectors that we're at above 35% for all of the applicants in each of the programs in terms of recipients, be they Caucasian or of person of color, and also that both males and females are fairly equally represented in our award recipients. In terms of raw numbers, women win by far and away the majority of the scholarships, but that's because two-thirds of our applicants are women. So Aspire is a program that helps us to reach out to the young men in our educational system, both secondary and post-secondary, to encourage them to apply as well. And I think if people had access to data that they saw, that there's a fairly good success rate for students who do choose to participate, that would encourage more participation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
I'm not tracking what's being shown here.
43%, the Native American, Alaskan Native percentage represents what? 43%.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, of the students who applied, who identified themselves as being Native American or Alaskan Native, that is a percentage of those who were actually awarded the scholarship that they had applied for.
Okay, so again, unpacking the percentages and displaying numbers tells a more complete story.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, we'd be glad to bring that data back for the committee.
It's the difference between 5 applications and 500, you know.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, because we have programs like CHAFE that does, you know, unfortunately in our foster care system, persons of color are overrepresented in that system. But CHAFE is a program that really helps us much more effectively reach out to those students. And in reaching out to them in the common application, they're applying not only for the CHAFE program, but for all of the 320 scholarships. And many of them have actually become recipients of the Ford scholarship programs. And so they have, by linking with the programs, really found a much broader opportunity than what just DHS could have offered to them.
Ms. Lowe, it's relatively clear to me that we are not going to be able to get to the priorities today. So can we complete the performance measures in the time left? And we will also come back. I will extend the hearing till tomorrow morning. Can you come back tomorrow morning?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can.
Yes. You'll have about 20 minutes tomorrow morning in which to complete the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the performance measures, the percentage of eligible students who are awarded the Oregon Opportunity Grant, this shows that previous performance measure that the committee had asked us to steer away from the 05 or the 03 session. In some ways, this is really more a kind of the partnership between the legislature and the agency, because the only way in which we could award to all students under our current constraints would be if we drastically reduced the size of the grant, which then would probably dramatically impact our ability to really make a difference. But right now we're at about 73% of the eligible population getting a grant. And in the governor's budget, we'd be able to extend that to all of the currently eligible population.
Would it be a fair statement to say that this performance measure really is more under the control of the legislature than it is under the control of the commission, because our level of funding and the level of grants that we could dictate more determine the number of participants that would actually, potential participants who could actually receive the grants?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. Again, we could serve all students, but it would be at a very watered down grant level, and I don't think that would be effective. So, the booklet actually then contains the detailed performance reports that we submit each year to the Oregon Progress Board. What I've not covered in detail here, but I would like to go over with the committee, are the performance measures that had to do with the student loan program. When I asked staff if this was something I should cover, they said that yes, I should, but probably not in as extensive a way. It has more to do with our past than our future. When you look at the performance measures for the scholarship program on the page that looks like this, you can see numbers 4, 5, and 6 are all the performance measures having to do with the student loan program. In number 4, the data for year 2004 actually shows a considerable increase. That increase in that particular data element was because of Portland State re-signing on to use OSAC as its guarantee agency. We had them as a client for 1 year, and then we lost them. And so the data in 2005 would show a very different picture in terms of loan volume activity. In number 5, that measure is the percentage of student loan defaults prevented. In this, the number that's on the page that you have is a typo. That number should have been 88%. and it is 88% on the detailed page further on in the packet. That 88% was less than what was hoped to be the performance level for the program at that point. And that was caused by two things. One, the problems that were going on in the Oregon economy was making it harder for students who were leaving school to find employment that gave them enough income to be able to repay their loans. In addition to that, the agency was beginning to experience a higher vacancy factor in the loan collection area as students... as the agency was retrenching because of declining revenues. And so both of those factors affected the performance in that category. In performance measure number 6, this measure was the percentage increase in annual dollars collected from average receivables. The percentage that's displayed here is actually a hybrid measure. And the numbers in both the upper part of the ratio and the lower part of the ratio can dramatically affect what your performance looks like. Unfortunately, both parts, the fraction, were suffering. The collections were declining because, again, of staff vacancies. And at the same time, our overall number of loans that we had were also declining, which was making the ratio suffer even further. All of those measures help to illustrate some of the challenges and difficulties that were going on in the loan program as resources were declining, as the state's economy was really moving through a very difficult time and making it harder and harder for the program to be viable. I'd be glad to cover any of the other more detailed measures that the committee might have, or perhaps we would want to close at this point and pick back up on the priorities tomorrow morning.
Why don't we stop at this point, and if there's anything that you think you still need to comment on in terms of performance measures tomorrow, do that at the beginning of your presentation, and then we'll take about 20 minutes in total to finish in terms of priorities, and you'll be back in phase two, and there probably will be more questions about performance measures then, and I think you've probably got a pretty good feeling for some of the detail that members of the committee would like to see in some of the performance measures, particularly the depiction of those. Are there any additional questions for the presenters at this time?
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just, I'm going to call it an observation. It's my sense that we're not spending enough time on the performance measures in this phase. I know we're going to go right into the priorities tomorrow, but it's just my sense that we're doing a flyby and we're not doing enough, getting enough detailed description of criteria and behind selections, and it's just not feeling very thorough to me this morning. I'm wanting something more. And I'll just leave it at that. We can talk about it off record.
Senator Gordley, we can try to do more of that in phase two. I thought that there, to some degree, there are items on page 66, and I know that they're trying to reflect those in their performance measures. I think the reality that I have to deal with right now, to be perfectly frank, and I do not know at this point how the performance measures are going to go for the Oregon University system, but at this point, whether it's the Department of Education, the State School Fund, Community Colleges and Workforce Development, the Oregon Health Sciences University, and now the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, all of the performance measures are in flux. And the co-chairs have brought forward issues with literally every performance measure in every area. So I think to get settled on performance measures by the end of this process, we're going to have to spend more time on them. And actually, the other thing that we are lacking is, because of the co-chair's direction, Mr. Bender, and Ms. McGlashan have been relatively silent during most of this discussion, and I do not anticipate that they will be silent during the Phase 2 portion of this discussion. So
I just want to be very clear that my observation and comments are not a criticism of the agency and their presentation. I'm more focusing on process on this end, on this side. So
I understand.
Not a criticism of the chair either.
I understand that clearly, and I think I clearly got the message in terms of one of the items you brought forward. You know, saying that 43%, I can't use percentages approximately, but saying 43% that applied received them doesn't really tell you if 13 applied and 5 or 6 received, or if 35 applied and, you know, and 15 or 20 actually received. It doesn't really give you a clear indication of what the results were. The numbers plus the percentages probably would give you a more clear indication. With that, I am going to close our meeting today, but I'm going to extend the public hearing on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to take an opportunity to thank Chair Clem and Commissioner Wheel and the other commissioners that are here and were here last week and for all their volunteer service to this cause. It's deeply appreciated.
Thank you. And if I might just respond to Senator Gordley's comments, any time that you find that you don't have enough time to explore things here, feel free to delegate those things to us, because we are surrogates in some ways of the legislature. That's why the commission exists. Is if you want something looked into, you want hearings held, you want us to do something, feel free to let me know and we'll do it.
With that, our hearing for tomorrow morning is extended on Senate Bill 5527 for approximately the first 30 minutes of our presentation tomorrow morning. And with that, I will close this meeting for today.